Brethren, we have a lot of people here tonight that are not what I would call old timers in the church. Some, their age gives them away. They're too young to be an old timer. Some have not been in the church that long. Some are not even a member of the Churches of Christ even right now. But not even talking about doctrine. I think a lot of us have seen a lot of changes in our brotherhood over the decades. Some really doesn't bother me and probably doesn't bother you, but there's some that is very, very alarming. And the only one I would like to point out tonight is our Sunday evening worship numbers. I can remember at one time when you would expect about a 20% drop-off between Sunday morning and Sunday night. And now I think in our brotherhood it's a 65 or 70% drop-off. We don't drop off quite that much, but we still drop off. And here's the point I would like to make. You know, if it's because of age that we can't get out, or maybe we can't drive at night because of age, maybe if that's the reason why we don't come back on Sunday night, I certainly understand that, and that is certainly justified. But our older members are usually here on Sunday night, so it's not that. But anyway, I just wanted to throw that out to you tonight. In fact, since I'm on a roll, let me continue just a little bit. Brethren, I've been here long enough that I think I know my audience pretty well. There's a completely different audience on Sunday morning than there is on Sunday night. The group that is here on Sunday night, for the most part, are more interested in in-depth Bible study. And I hope that it's obvious that over the at least the last few years, I've tried to make my Sunday night sermons even more biblically challenging than the Sunday morning. But if you ever have a question or a need of anything that's said, not only in a Sunday night sermon, but at any time, I really believe that some of the more mature members of the congregation can help you with that. But if you need to talk to me, feel free to come and talk to me about that. I certainly stand beside or behind anything that I say. In just a moment, our reading and our study is going to come from John chapter 2. John chapter 2. Now, there are several things that I think we need to discuss as far as groundwork for us to get the real application of this story. And maybe using my introduction a moment ago about being more challenging on Sunday night, I think there is some information in this particular casual story that we failed to get. We'll be digging into that tonight. But our reading will come from John chapter 2. Now, we need to remember one thing. This is at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. In fact, we're going to talk about Bible chronology, or the chronological order that the Bible follows and sometimes does not follow at all times. We were even talking about that a little bit before our services tonight. But it's very important, I believe, for us to understand and realize that this came at the very beginning of Jesus' ministry. I'm not saying that Jesus would not have performed this miracle later in his ministry, but I think, at least my thinking is, he would handle it perhaps a little bit different. So let's look at a few of the facts. First of all, Galilee is a very small community. That's where Jesus was from. That's where his mother was from. That's where most of the area, or the apostles, were from that area. But an even smaller little village is called Cana. Cana of Galilee. Cana near Galilee. And there was a wedding. And first of all, as you're reading there, Mary was invited to the wedding. Now, this is something else that came up really in our discussion earlier in the evening. Brethren, I think the internet is one of the most useful tools for studying the Bible ever. Whereas people used to always come and use our library, and we have and had such a wonderful library over the decades, people really don't use the library that much. We study, they study on the internet. And I think it is a wonderful tool. But we need to be very, very cautious when we study on the internet. The books that are in our church library, and probably most church libraries, have been recommended to be there. In other words, someone knows that book, they recommend that book Others then will have an opportunity to use that book, and if it is questionable or if it is not good, we will take it out of the library. You cannot do that on the internet. I say that in order to say this. When I first started gathering internet information to give tonight in this lesson, and it says that Mary was invited, Mary was there, someone came up with the harebrained idea, she must have been the wedding coordinator. Well, there's no indication of that whatsoever. She did seems to be the first one to notice there was a problem, but Mary was not the wedding coordinator. She was invited there, as was Jesus, as was the rest of his apostles, and they run into a problem. They ran out of wine. They ran out of wedding refreshment. And Mary says to Jesus, now if you're reading from the King James Version, and I read from the King James Version, but this is a spot I really think the King James is more confusing than the New King James, and that's what I'll read in this. As we're leaving verse 3 and going into verse 4, Mary says to Jesus, they have no wine. Jesus said to her, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour is not yet come. They've run out of wine. What does that have to do with Jesus? That's his question. He, first of all, is not being rude. I read a few commentaries that said, well, Jesus was being rude to say that to his mother. I think they're misreading Jesus' words. I don't see any rudeness whatsoever. What did the volume of their refreshment have to do with Jesus in the first place? He wasn't a wine merchant. What did it have to do with him? That's all that he is saying. But there was a problem. Now, brethren, here is where I'm going to put my neck a little bit on the line tonight. And if you disagree with me, that is certainly fine. I cannot prove what I'm about to say, but I will be able to prove our application. I think the way this fell into place, Mary was asking Jesus to perform a miracle. Now, I'm not saying that she had ever seen miracles before, but Mary, of all people in the entire world, knew that this was God's only begotten Son. The way it transpires in this story, they've run out of wine. Jesus, they've run out of wine. Take care of the situation. I think she was asking Jesus to perform a miracle. Now, there were several commentaries that disagree with me. Maybe you do as well, and that is certainly not fine. I'm not being dogmatic at all. And the final thing I would like to say deals with his comeback to her, my hour is not yet come. Now, I don't think I found anyone who disagreed, and I think you will agree with me on this as well. What Jesus is saying is, it's not time for me to display myself as the Son of God. It's not time for me to start confirming who I am with signs and wonders and miracles. So maybe we disagree on some of that. I think, though, we're all in agreement with that. So there was a problem. They ran out of refreshment. And his mother is just like a lot of mothers that I have known in my lifetime. Mary thought, my son can do anything. And so she calls that to his attention and even jumps the gun, as we'll read in just a moment, ignores actually what Jesus says and continues to press the point. Let me read for now from verse number 6. Now there was set, I'm going to have to use my glasses tonight. I don't know what's wrong with my eyes tonight. Now there was set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece. These are big water pots. Jesus said to them, that would be the servants, fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. And when the master of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, he did not know where it came from. But the servants who had drawn the water knew. The master of the feast called the bridegroom, and he said to him, every man at the beginning, every bridegroom at the beginning sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, I don't need to explain that, then he brings out the inferior wine. But you have kept the best wine until now. And then verse 11, this was the beginning of the signs. This was the beginning of Jesus' miracles that he did in Galilee, which manifest his glory, and the disciples believed on him, or believed in him. They believed now, this is truly who Jesus says he is. This is the Son of God. You know, isn't it amazing? Jesus is even referenced in the Old Testament as the Lord of all lords and the King of all kings. Here is a Jew of pure Jewish stock. Why would Jesus display his first mighty miracle in Cana of Galilee? That's almost like saying 6 Mile of Port Lavaca. Why would he not go to Jerusalem? Why would he not go to the temple? Why would he not call the high priest and all the other priests? Why would he not call everyone to get their attention and perform his first mighty miracle there? Well, maybe that was his plan, though I don't believe it was. But his mother got the ball rolling. Now, one thing we need to remember. Jesus performed a lot of miracles, but they were always for a purpose. I can only think of 2 reasons why Jesus performed miracles. One, to confirm the word, to confirm that he was who he said he was. And then sometimes he performs a miracle strictly out of compassion. He feels sorry for someone and he performs a miracle. But we also need to remember what John said right toward the end of his gospel account. And many other signs or miracles or wonders, many other signs did Jesus in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. I don't know if that's the New Testament or John's account of the gospel, probably. They are not written in this book, but these are written so that we might believe that Jesus is the Christ and that believing we might have life through his name. But let's not stop there, because John doesn't stop. John goes on to say, if every miracle that Jesus did was written out in detail, the world would not be able to contain all the books that need to be written. So Jesus was a miracle worker. He worked miracles to confirm who he was. He worked miracles for compassion. This was a miracle, though, that he was just not ready to do. In fact, I believe had it not been for Mary's insistence, he might not have performed this miracle either, but that's really beside the point. So this miracle of John chapter 2 is special, if for no other reason than it's the first miracle he ever did, or at least the first miracle he ever did in public. Now here's where I want to challenge us in our study. We're going to make our application points of this story very soon. But brethren, I believe many times, in fact, maybe all the time, we miss the real teaching of Jesus' story here, or this incident in Jesus' life, because we fail to see the power of Jesus as the master teacher. Now, here is Jesus. He goes to a wedding. They run out of refreshment. At his mother's insistence, or because he wanted to, he performed this miracle. Is there a lesson there to be learned? I say there is. Now, what was the law before Jesus? The law of the patriarchs, the law of Moses. Compared to the law of Jesus, the royal law, they were inferior, just like the first wine that was served was inferior to the latter wine, so the teaching of Moses, the teaching of Elijah on the Mount of Transfiguration pales compared to the teaching of Jesus. Brethren, Jesus was consistent in everything he taught and said. And one thing he said from the very beginning of his ministry to the very end, even right before his ascension, is, my teaching is the only teaching that's going to get us to heaven. So the first wine that was served, satisfied their palate. But the second wine, even the master of the wedding said, this is superior. The teaching of Jesus is superior to everything else. That was also our lesson last Sunday morning, the Mount of Transfiguration. The teaching of Moses was perfect for what it was designed to do, get the children of Israel's attention. The teaching of the prophets, though I think it was very limited in its acceptance by the people, did what it was designed to do, to point out the error of Judaism. But they pale compared to the teaching of Jesus. And that's why the voice of God said, this is my beloved son. This is the one you need to listen to. Moses was not transfigured. Elijah was not transfigured. Only Jesus was. So sometimes time passes that way, and that's the case. I got a little ahead of myself. Now I want to talk about Bible chronology, the chronological order that the Bible gives us. Now, I'm not saying that the Bible does not give us all the truth that we need, because indeed it does. But sometimes time will pass, and for some reason, the Holy Spirit didn't see fit to let us know that time is passing. Sometimes in the life of the Apostle Paul, he might be in prison for a couple of years, but that was just one chapter earlier. So we lose track of Bible time. Sometimes it's even in the same verse things happen. Well, we have a problem with Bible chronology at this particular case. In our reading from John chapter 1, we see that Jesus was baptized. In John chapter 2, he's already called his disciples and they attend a wedding feast at Cana. But what about Matthew chapter 4? In Matthew chapter 4, Matthew tells us that immediately after Jesus was baptized, what? He was led by the Spirit into the wilderness to be tempted by Satan. What happened to that? Well, it just wasn't needed in John's account of this particular time frame. So Matthew gives it to us. So Jesus has been baptized. He went to the wilderness, was tempted by Satan. Now he has drawn his disciples. And his mother and he and his disciples now go to the marriage feast in Cana. And as the Bible does more often than not, we cut right to the chase. There's a problem. They encounter a problem. Now, brethren, I'm not going to ask for a show of hands tonight, but if I ask you, raise up your hand if you've ever had a problem. You know, it's just kind of silly to even think of it that way, is it not? We've all had problems. Actually, on the scheme of things, this is not very important to me that they ran out of refreshment. But it was, I suppose, to them. But there is a problem. And Mary steps in and she decides to take it on herself to help take care of this problem. And though maybe she jumped the gun a bit, maybe she did not, though maybe she jumped the gun a bit, she gives us a wonderful teaching by application. If there's a problem, take it to Jesus. If a problem comes in our life, take it to Jesus. Not just spiritual problems. Not just prayers for the sick. Any problem that we have, we take it to Jesus. Remember what John says, Jesus said in John 14, verse 13, whatever you ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. If we have a problem, take it to Jesus. Now we pause again. If you're interested in the specifics of this refreshment, if you're interested in the specifics, we're not going to cover that in this lesson tonight. If you're interested in those specifics, I encourage you to get a good Bible dictionary, a good Bible lexicon, go to a reputable site on the internet and study it. I will go ahead and tell you, though, it's a difficult study because there are Greek words and there are even some Hebrew words that describe everything from grape Kool-Aid all the way to strong alcoholic beverage and everything in between. In fact, the most popular of all the Greek words, onos, sometimes is used to describe alcoholic beverage, and sometimes the same word is used to describe non-alcoholic beverage. Here's the point I'm trying to make, and don't listen to what I say, and don't get angry at what I say. I think we in the brotherhood sometimes get so busy debating the specifics that we fail to reach the proper application. That's why the story is given to us. In 2 Timothy chapter 2, verse 7, Paul is talking about a group who were ever learning but never able to come to a knowledge of the truth. Let's make sure that's not us. Let's debate the specifics of this study if you want to. Come to me, I'll come to you. It is a wonderful study, but let's not use that debate to miss the application. The application, as we've already stated, if there's a problem, Jesus is the problem solver. We need to take it to him. So there is a problem. Jesus is asked to take care of it, and he does take care of it, and he performs his first mighty miracle. And from there, things begin to change. Now, here's where I don't know if Mary actually jumped the gun or if all along this was God's plan. It's really a moot discussion. But things began to change. Because now Jesus is recognized as one who can perform miracles. Now, brethren, there are other people that could do signs or wonders or miracles in the Bible that were not given that power by God. That's not our discussion tonight either. But I like to call to attention the signs that God gave to Moses when he went to Israel to secure the release of the Israelites. Throw your staff down, or Aaron's staff down, it'll turn into a serpent. The magicians of Pharaoh did the same thing. Now, Moses' serpent ate up their serpents, but they were able to do the same thing. That's, though, not our discussion now, but things began to change. And from here to the next 3 years, Jesus' fame began to spread. We mentioned Cana of Galilee. It began to spread through that area. It came through Samaria. It got down into Judea. It even reached Jerusalem itself. They had heard of Jesus before he ever set foot that we know of in the city other than at 12 years of age. So whether Mary jumped the gun or not is actually moot. Jesus said to her, "That's not my concern right now. My time is not yet come." But the application is this: truth then is truth now. We need to find the application. So, my first point of application: we just need to do what Jesus tells us to do. You know, if we would just accept that as our daily plan of life, to just do what Jesus tells us to do, we could avoid so much personal problem, and we could avoid so much problem in the world as well. Just do what Jesus tells us to do, because Jesus has everything he needs, everything that's necessary to take care of every problem that you and I and the rest of the world has at any particular time. Truth then is truth now. Jesus has the answer to the problems of our personal life, our family life, at work, at school, or anywhere else. Truth then is truth now. He can heal any circumstance. He can take a life that appears barren and forlorn and refresh it to the point of being used again. It's like a garment that we're ready to throw away. Jesus can take that worn, threadbare garment and fix it. If it's broken, Jesus can fix it. Now let's look at the story. There was a problem. It came to Jesus and he fixed it. Those servants did what Jesus told them to do. Now I don't want to jump on them. I don't want to assume something in them. But if they had not have done what Jesus told them to do, those jars would still be filled with water. They needed to do what he told them to do, and we need to do the same as well. He takes a problem, and he becomes the solution. Yes, in a sense, it's still my problem, but Jesus is the solution. Let me share a few verses with you. I know Hebrews 13:15 is talking about deity. It's talking about God, but it is talking about deity, where God says, I will never leave you nor forsake you. Isn't that comforting? In Matthew 18, verse 20, where Jesus is talking about where two or three are gathered together in his name, he says, I'm right there with you. Isn't that comforting? When Jesus commissioned the disciples in Matthew 28 toward the great commission, going into the world and baptizing believers, he also said, I'll be with you always, even to the end of the world. And I like to use Psalm 23, though I know David was talking about Jehovah God, but even in the valley of the shadow of death, we can fear no evil because God is with us. And then we need to learn that. We need to live that. Jesus can do what he says he's going to do. And we just need to do what he tells us to do. Now, I fear sometimes that even strong Christians find that their faith has been, challenged. Even strong Christians, their faith has been challenged. It's got to be something major in our life. Our faith is not challenged by minor things. But something major happens. And even the strongest Christian, their faith is challenged. You know, I know people in this congregation. I won't mention any names. Maybe they're here, maybe they're not. You don't even need to guess. That has had more problems in his life than most Christians face in a lifetime. And he's that over the last several months. But he's remained strong because his faith is stronger than any problem that the world throws at us. So if your faith is ever brought to question, just say, I have faith in God. But if our faith is questioned, it still puts us in a pretty good company. You remember the Apostle Thomas? Maybe we call him Doubting Thomas, but wasn't he just questioning his faith? Unless I put my hands into the pierced side, unless I put my finger in the nail prints, then my faith will be revived. How about the Apostle Peter? We talked about him this morning. Three times before the rooster crows, you're going to deny me. His faith was challenged, but with Thomas and with Peter and with us, once we fortify our faith, God can use us so much more now than he did ever before. But we've got to get beyond that. He can lift us up. He can lift us up. He can lift us up. Jesus can do it. That's the point we learn from this. Jesus can do it. Now we begin our close with verse 11. This was the beginning of the miracles that Jesus did, which manifested his glory, and his disciples began to believe on him. The word "began" is not in any of the translations, but I feel that maybe it should be there. Again, everything Jesus did had a purpose. Every miracle, every teaching, every conversation, every interest. He is the master teacher. He confirmed who he was and he showed compassion. Now in that verse, the King James, in fact most other translation, uses the word signs. Jesus did signs in the presence of his disciples. What is a sign? Let's say you need to take a trip tomorrow and you're on a highway and you're not familiar with that highway. What's the first thing you need to be doing? Looking at the road signs. You need to look at the road signs. Maybe you're coming up to an intersection and you're not ready for it, or maybe your GPS is not hooked up correctly or something. You need to know that. Maybe you need to change lanes because this road is going this way and this road is going that way. Maybe there's a detour. Maybe there's a school zone. My favorite one, I had to start smiling when I thought of this, even in the middle of July and August, on top of these bridges here in South Texas, be careful, there might be ice. I'm sorry, that one just cracks me up. But we need to follow the signs. Jesus gave these signs for us to follow. What happened when Jesus did this miracle, this sign? He received glory. His name was known from then on, and it spread and it spread and it spread. And also the Father received glory. You know, on a number of occasions, Jesus would say something like this: I can of mine own self do nothing. As my Father saith, so say I. So Jesus didn't come here to get his name up in lights. He didn't come here to make a name for himself. He came to make a name for his Father. It's God's plan. But number three, and this is where our application is, his disciples begin to realize Jesus really is the Son of God. Now, brethren, I don't question the sincerity of religious people that claim to have seen a miracle. I don't question their sincerity. I just don't read the Bible the same way they do. But I'll speak only for myself. I've never seen a miracle. I've never seen a spiritual sign or a wonder. But I walk by faith and not by sight. Oh, I would love to see them. I would love for somebody to go to Port Lavaca Hospital or MD Anderson and just walk up and down the aisles and cure all of the people of their illness. I would love to see that. But I still believe in God, and I still believe in His Son, and I still believe in the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, though I have never seen anything like that. But I believe we've missed the main point in this story. The teaching of Jesus replaced the teaching of the Old Testament. The first wine was good. It was not as good as the second wine. The teaching of Moses and Elijah was good, not as good as Jesus's, because Jesus's teaching is perfect. It's called the perfect law of liberty. Perfect meaning it has no flaws. Now, the Old Testament, we can learn so much about that. But there's a different set of entrance standards in the New Testament than there was in the Old Testament. If you wanted to be a child of God in the Old Testament, all you had to do was have Jewish parents. That's all it took. If you were born a Jew, you were a child of Israel. You were a chosen one of God. Similar but different. If we want to be a child of spiritual Israel, if we want to be a child of God today, birth is still involved, but it's not birth to a physical father and mother. It's birth to a spiritual father in heaven, and it's called baptism. It's a new birth, and the classic has to be in John chapter 3, the very next chapter, when Jesus is talking to Nicodemus, and he said, Nicodemus, you have to be born again. Not to go into your mother's tummy and be born physically, but go into the water of baptism and be born spiritually. So though I don't really think there's anyone here tonight who, having reached a degree of maturity, hasn't already rendered obedience to what we call the primary principles of the gospel, we don't want to ever miss an opportunity to extend the invitation. So if you tonight need to be baptized, or if you need to respond for any other reason, Mike is making his way to the mic.